Welcome back to another MiningStockEducation.com expert interview. I'm Bill Powers. Joining me on the line is Mr. Keith Neumeyer, President and CEO of First Majestic Silver Corporation, to discuss last week's flash crash in silver. Unlike many mining CEOs whose background was in geology or engineering before they became a CEO, Keith is unique in that before becoming a mining CEO, he had extensive experience in the financial markets and as a trader, which gives him a better grasp of how markets work and equip him to analyze the market occurrence that we saw last week in the silver market. Keith, thank you for joining me today.
Well, Bill, it's nice to chat. It's our first interview, so and also it's a green day. I see the markets are up today, which is really nice to see. It's been unusual for the last couple of weeks to see actually green on the screen.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there was a lot of red for 1 minute last week, and when I reached out to you for the interview, I wanted to get your take on what's called the flash crash in silver that occurred last week, where with the September silver future contracts, the price in U.S. dollars went from $16.06 all the way down, a 10.7% drop to $14.34 in the matter of 1 minute, before the next 3 minutes shooting back up 11% to end about at $15.90, which is about 4.4% of the annual mine supply of silver traded in a matter of about 4 minutes. Keith, could you help us understand what occurred there? What went on?
Well, sure. You know, I find it quite fascinating that the market names these kinds of moves flash crashes. You know, I remember the first one ever. It was a few years ago. I forget exactly the year it was, but it was approximately 3 or 4 years ago when the Dow Jones was down 1,000 points in a matter of 10 or 15 minutes. And, you know, it was a computer glitch and, you know, some algos went wrong and they halted the market and they went in and, of course, canceled all the trades and, you know, everything, you know, went back to normal. And then, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, we saw another flash crash on several high-tech stocks on the NASDAQ, and of course, same thing happens. Headlines hit, flash crash happens on the NASDAQ. NASDAQ steps in, cancels all the trades, and everything goes back to normal. So another algo going wrong. But in the case of this so-called flash crash, there was no headlines. There was no cancellation of trades. There was no apology that came out from the CME or the COMEX or the CFTC, you know, saying that, oh my goodness, you know, the computers went haywire and we're canceling the trades and everyone's going to be okay. There was no actions like that at all. So what that tells me is that this was purposefully done. And it was done by some very, very powerful people behind the scenes who the regulators just simply don't want to go after.
And so you wouldn't take the view that the less cynical view would be that this was maybe a tap on the shoulder, a margin call, and a forced liquidation. But would you say that there's probably no entity other than a large bank or a government-run entity that could cause such a flash crash?
Well, considering your long position on silver is maximum 1,500 contracts, so you as an individual or corporation, any entity at all, cannot purchase more than 1,500 contracts long. So how would you sell over 1,500 contracts, right? So it has to be not a long position. So it can't be a short, it cannot be a margin call, because that would suggest that you've got a call against, you know, a long position. So this is definitely a concerted short selling attack by either one group, and, you know, James Turk came out the other day and said it was the government. I'm not sure how he comes to that conclusion, but he has his views and he's a well-respected guy. So, okay, let's say it was a government or it was a group of individuals or a group, and likely not a group of individuals because it's too big of a trade. So it's a group of banks that work together, very similar to what we've seen from Deutsche Bank and UBS and others, you know, in the latest, manipulation lawsuit that's been underway and where the one fellow from Deutsche has now been accused of being the, you know, head of the whole scheme, and quite interestingly enough, the CFTC has now hired him as an inside man to look for other manipulation type of activities that other banks are doing.
When this occurs, who are the biggest losers?
Well, the average guy on the street, and of course the miners, and of course the people that work for the miners. So we employ 4,000 people at First Majestic, and we're in these towns, these mines. We have six mines in Mexico, each town that is the neighbor of these mines rely on these mines. If these mines didn't exist, these towns simply would not exist. So there's approximately another 30,000+ people that living in these towns surrounding these mines that rely on these mines for employment or for income, you know, in their restaurants and stores or hotels or what have you, selling services to the mine or selling just services to the people that work at the mines. So, you know, it's very critical. So all of a sudden, you know, the silver price drops the way it has. And, you know, we employed 5,500 people if you go back to January 2012, just as the market started to turn over and then start to go down. Today, we're about 3,900 people. And you know, that's a lot of people to lay off over that period of time. It's very unfortunate, and it's all to do with the metal price.
That's a very holistic answer. Oftentimes, we think about the little guy in the market or maybe some smaller firms, but you brought it down to the village level in Mexico, and that's very true, and thank you for bringing that up. Last January in 2016, when the silver spot price was about $14.42, all of a sudden one day, the silver fix in London was set at $13.58 an ounce. What occurred there, and can you make any comparisons or contrast what occurred there with the flash crash in silver last week?
Well, that was a different situation. That was where the London fix was actually 80 cents below spot. And I remember that incident quite a lot. Fortunately, First Majestic doesn't fix much of its metal on spot. The spot affects the miners that are producing concentrate. Most of our production is in the form of dory bars, so we don't use the fix. But unfortunately, there's a lot of big miners that, of course, rely on the fix, and it's the banks that are paying them money, you know, based on that fix on a daily basis. So they're delivering, you know, concentrates, silver concentrates, or concentrates that contain silver, you know, into these banks, for an 80 cent difference between what the miner actually received and what spot was actually trading at the time was a crime. It was a criminal action as far as I'm concerned. And a number of miners did come out and complain. There was actually a couple of articles. I think Reuters did an article on it at the time and interviewed a couple of the big miners that were affected quite negatively by that. But yet, of course, it just disappears into Never Never Land. It's never talked about again.
To prevent the flash crash that we saw last week from happening again, is there anything the regulatory bodies need to do, or is it simply just enforcing the laws that are already on the books?
Well, that would be exactly the words I would use. It's not a matter of the regulators needing more rules. There's, being an ex-trader, you know, I know what the rules are, you know, when it comes to trading anything, let alone, you know, commodities there's a lot of, you know, activity that goes on in the space, not just in the metal space, but around the world, that are done by, you know, computers and very sophisticated traders that, whether it's, you know, I'm not of the, belief that, you know, the regulators are anywhere, you know, corrupt in any way or in collusion with the banks. I'm not there. And I know there are people that conclude that, but being part of the system, I don't believe that. You know, the banks are highly regulated, and they don't like to be sued. You know, they have shareholders as well, just like, you know, our company does, and you know, they try to do everything above the book. So at least as far as I'm concerned, they do. But you know, now and then, you know, traders do get offside and do make bad decisions, and they try to protect their book. They get offside in a position. Let's say you own, a million ounces of silver, and all of a sudden this, you know, the silver is going against you. You're going to try to hold the price in there as best as you can, you know, to protect your book. And unfortunately, it happens mostly on the short side because most of the banks are short the metal. And the reason why that is because it's an industrial metal. So, you know, if you're JP Morgan or HSBC or Scotia, you know, you have miners that you're buying the metal from, but you have actual manufacturers who rely on the metal to produce televisions, for its automobiles, computers, you know, cell phones, solar panels, you know, batteries, electric cars, and, you know, all the things that we use silver for. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, one of these big banks sells Sony 50 million ounces of silver at $17 an ounce. and silver's $20, you know, it's all of a sudden that trade is going to cost that bank more money. So, you know, it's, you know, the whole word manipulation, I know a lot of people use it, you know, I, and quite frankly, I've used it myself many times, because when I see banks acting collectively to price anything, and they have an idea in mind where they want to price it, that's manipulation. But if someone's acting solely on their own and just protecting a position, like in the case of the example I gave you, that's, you know, more like protecting your book. And it's hard to really differentiate between what's actually going on in the marketplace. Are these people actually trying to protect their book, or they're actually manipulating the markets?
Considering the way the silver price is set and the silver markets, as a CEO of a silver mining company, what can you do to maximize profits when you sell your company's silver onto the market? And how exactly does First Majestic sell its silver?
Well, the banks, you know, ultimately the you know, the final buyer of the metals, and that's just the way the system works. And you know, we're a mining company, and we're in the system. You know, I see that there's a couple of traders that ex-traders from Glencore. I just read an article the other day who are trying to set up a eBay type system where the buyers and sellers could actually go on, you know, a kind of a web-based portal and actually buy and sell metals outside of the current system. It's in discussion stages only, and they have not started the process, but they're in the early stages of actually formulating this new way of doing things in the metal space. So I'm actually optimistic that we might be able to get away from the current way things are done. But just to explain to your listeners how it's actually done. Now, I already said there's a concentrate producer and there's a doré producer, so they're quite different animals. In the case of concentrate, I don't want to spend, you know, 30 minutes discussing this because it does get complicated. But in the case of concentrates, it's based on an average price over the preceding 30 days. And these concentrates get put on a ship, and they're stored at a port, and they get blended, they get put on a ship, and they're shipped to faraway places like Korea, like Japan, like China, and they're used in, they're put into smelters, and they're broken down into all the different metals that are in that concentrate, you know, be it gold or silver, lead or zinc or copper. You know, concentrate contains multiple metals and not just one metal, so they break it all down, and the miner will get paid X amount, you know, based on all the costs associated with getting that concentrate over to that smelter, and that pricing takes place on the average trading price of the metal for the preceding 30 days. So it's a little bit complicated, but they get a check in the mail or a wire transfer, and everyone's happy. In the case of doré bars, and this is where First Majestic steps in, is being a trader, in my earlier life, I've actually been very good at timing the market. So we can actually sell metal on spikes, and we've done it continually over the last 15 years of business, and I've actually beaten the average trading price of COMEX and silver, I think virtually every quarter for the last 10 years, except for maybe two or three quarters. So I've done quite well doing it. And because of the volatility in silver, you know, if silver's up 50 cents over the space of a week or up a buck over the space of a couple of weeks, you know, I'll sell into that rally and sell, you know, a few weeks of production. And then, of course, you know, silver tends to always correct, and then all of a sudden our shareholders, you know, see it in our financial statements. Our average selling price for the quarter has actually been pretty good compared to what the average selling price of the metal was over that period of time. And we then deliver the metal to the refinery from Mexico. It goes into the United States, mostly to a refinery in Florida. They refine it, and the bank, who is the buyer of that metal, instructs the refinery where to send it, and it could go anywhere. It could stay within the United States, used in windows, used in circuit boards, used in, you know, a variety of different applications, or it could get shipped overseas. Europe is a big consumer. Silver is, of course, and the electronics industry in China, of course, are huge consumers of silver. So we don't generally get involved. Well, we never get involved with actually where the silver ends up. We get involved only in the pricing of it, and then the delivery of it, and then we get paid upon delivery.
In your experience and observation, are other mining CEOs as strategic in their selling as you are for First Majestic?
I don't think so. I haven't done a detailed comparison, but when I have looked at other mining companies, because I am quite interested in what their average selling price for their quarter is, and it's a number I look at, I guess just because it's something I tend to focus on, but and I often find, I think most often find, that their averages are always below First Majestic's averages.
Keith, last year, First Majestic was my largest position in terms of percentage of my portfolio and capital invested, and I did really well with your company last year. Could you, before you leave, could you share with listeners what's the outlook for First Majestic in the second half of 2017 going into 2018?
So did you sell your stock at $20?
I bought it all under $3. I watched it go over $19 US dollars, and then I watched it go back down to $7, $8, and I sold around $9 at the end of last year, but I plan on re-entering.
Okay. Well, that's at least you made money, and you got in at the right time, and it's the correction that happened in mid-2016, I think, surprised everyone. First of all, the rally surprised everyone. We saw First Majestic go up 500%. It was the actual, the best performing company, not mining company, best performing company on the Toronto Stock Exchange in the first 6 months of 2016. So it was quite the feat to have that accomplishment. But and that's the leverage. That's what happens with First Majestic. It's done that before. And I'm sure it'll do it again in the future. And I've said previously, if you look at the move on how silver and the stock react together, if you just do the simple math, for every dollar in silver price, the stock moves about $3. So there's a 3x, beta there to the silver price, which is pretty phenomenal. I don't think there's another, I'm pretty confident to say I don't think there's another silver miner out there that has that kind of leverage to the price. So the stock is down 50% from, actually more than that, it's down 60% from its peak in 2016. And, I'm a bull on the metal. I'm biased. I'm probably not the one to be telling people to buy First Majestic. I think people should be making up their own mind. But if people like silver, First Majestic is really one of the premier silver companies out there, and it performs better than most in a bull market. It is a bit of a double edged sword. Unfortunately, there are companies out there that produce less percentage of silver. We're around 70% of our revenues from silver. That'll change in 2018 to about 80%, and there's no one that comes close. Hecla's 30%, Pan American Silver is about 50%, Silver Wheaton is about 45%, 40%. So we're really up there. So for individuals that really want to have silver exposure, I think First Majestic is really one that you have to have in your portfolio. But if silver does go against you, it can be painful, because it does move the same dollar for $3 move up. It's the same, when the price goes down. So it can be painful, as we've witnessed over the last 12 months. A bit of advice, the mining sector, it's tough, right? So, of course I'm biased when it comes to First Majestic and First Mining Finance, my two companies that, I run. I think they're both very, very good companies. But from a investor perspective, people really should look at management. What has management done in the past? What have they built? How much wealth, or have they created wealth historically? Because I don't want to point fingers at mining. I see this in all industries, in the high tech sector, and any industry where you get a bull market coming, as we do currently in the tech sector, and you get a lot of people coming in and putting together somewhat shoddy companies. And I think we're seeing it in the marijuana space as well. So, the investors just have to, forget about the hype, forget about the story. First thing you do is look at the management, look at what they've achieved in the past, look how much stock they own. Do they have a vested interest? And watch the insider trading reports and see if they're buying stock, see if they're selling stock. And know, I see so often, you know, when I get promoted a company, and I go right to their, it's called a circular, a management circular. You can get it on the internet. People should learn how to find these documents because they're available publicly. You do some research, find the circular, go on there, and see what the management owns. And it's shocking how often I look at these companies and the management don't own any stock.
Absolutely. Well, Keith, I appreciate you stopping by and sharing your insights. Thank you very much.
Well, it's great talking to you, Bill, and hopefully we can do this again.
Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.